Okay, so we're going to begin. Just for those who weren't here last time, basically, if you have comments or questions, it's probably easiest to email it at the bottom or send a message, and then we can discuss it. I'll stop at various times. This is second class. Today, I think we're probably going to finish German Orthodoxy, the first generation. Next class, move into Rav Kook, although we might continue a little bit next class as well. Basically, we're going to be showing that Hirsch's one model, German Orthodoxy, is one model, focusing on emancipation, secular studies. Then we'll see Rav Kook that brings in Zionism, that aspect, Jewish nationalism, which is certainly important to modern Orthodoxy. And then we're going to conclude the last class and a half, or the last class, with a modern Orthodox approach to halakha, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg in particular. We ended last class, I have on my notes, that according to Breuer, Hirsch never really believed in a synthesis, although that's often the phrase used. Yeshiva University adopted the model of synthesis. Rather, he believed that Torah and secular were separate components, but that joined together and influenced each other. In fact, according to Hirsch, he said that he saw no danger for Jewish children even being exposed to Christian ideas. I mentioned this last class as well. We're going to pick up with this. Together with everything we said last class, Hirsch altered what was a major, I guess, value, you could say, of traditional Judaism, namely Torah Lishma, Torah study for its own sake. This finds its classic expression in Rav Chaim of Volozhin. It's found in the yeshiva world, where you sit and study Talmud for its own sake. In traditional society, Torah was studied for its own sake, and this determined your status in the community, your marriage prospects, everything else. For Hirsch, and we'll talk about this right now, learning, or learning in Yiddish, was not the center of his value system. Piety was. There was no ideal for Hirsch of Torah Lishma in the classic sense, and the rigid religious layperson, the average Baal HaBayit, the Baal HaBas, not the Torah scholar, was the backbone of Judaism for Hirsch. Emphasis in the Hirschian community was given to the Siddur, to Tanakh, to the Psalms. Hirsch wrote commentaries and all that. He never established a yeshiva. He wanted to establish a yeshiva, but he never got around to it. The time wasn't right. But even had he established it, it wouldn't have been like the East European yeshivas. He would have had different focus. The focus would have been a lot on Hashkafa, on ideology, on Tanakh, on practical halakha. Hirsch was never focused on training Talmudic scholars, or for that matter, on training rabbis. His goal was to create a community of religious balabatim, an all-encompassing religious society. He was successful in doing that. The model, he called it, the approach, was Torah im Derech Eretz. We spoke about that last time. In fact, his students used the term more than he. But what does Torah im Derech Eretz mean? It means combining whatever civilization you live in with Torah. Now, Hirsch saw God's hand in everything. In the yeshiva world, the focus, as we said and we know, is on Torah study alone. Hirsch, we know how excited he got when he went to Switzerland. He came back raving about how he saw God. Where did he see God? In the mountains of Switzerland, the beauty of Switzerland. There is beauty in the world, the beauty of Japheth, the Japheth, to be combined in the tents of shame. And those who ignore it do so at their own loss. German philosophy, German culture, are a natural partner for Judaism. And he elaborates on this in his famous Schiller speech I mentioned last class. It's not translated in the English volume, but it was a commemoration of Hirsch's birthday, and Hirsch stresses that it's not about Jewish versus Gentile truth. Rather, all truth has the same origin in God, and when we study other truths, it helps us with our Judaism as well. He couldn't have been more opposed to the traditional view that all truth is in the Torah, and I mentioned last class that he pointed to Talmudic passages that speak of the sages studying from non-Jewish thinkers. Now, he wrote as follows. He has a famous essay called, quote, The Relevance of Secular Studies to Jewish Education. And in this, he writes that a good secular education, this is a quote, can give our young people essential new insights, added dimensions that will enrich their religious training. Any supporter of education and culture should deplore the fact that when these secular studies are evaluated in terms of usefulness to the young, too much stress is often placed on so-called utility and necessity. In other words, the purpose of secular studies is not to get a job, not how they're going to help you in the world. They have independent advantages, independent value. He continues, there is a spiritual harvest that can be won from secular studies. Our understanding of the philosophy of life and the Weltanschauung taught in the sacred writings of the Jewish religion is dependent in no small measure on our insights into the character and development of nature and society. All this points again to Hirsch's major goal, which is to create a community, not intellectuals, religious balabatim. He wasn't interested in bringing culture to the Jews of Eastern Europe. That was a different world. He was interested in bringing Torah to the Jews of the modern world, Jews who are already integrated into modern society. Well, certainly, Hirsch said, no one who's read Hirsch believes that it was a b'dievet. I mean, that is, the yeshiva world has two approaches. I was going to talk about it in a minute, so I'll mention it right now. One is that his view was valuable for Germany, but not elsewhere. And the other, famously stated by Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz, was that it was only a horat shah, an emergency measure. But these people never read Hirsch's writings. No follower of Hirsch ever thought that. Hirsch is explicit. That's not the case. And we'll see in a minute that Rabbi Dessler knows it's not the case as well. You can look at the Art Scroll biography of Hirsch, and he totally demolishes this viewpoint. No one who seriously knows Hirsch's writings can believe that. But what is important is that Hirsch was not interested in converting all the East European Jews into Torah and Derech Eretz followers. There were people who tried to do that during World War I. But Hirsch believed that his job was only to look out for the German Jews, and he thought that was the way to live life. The East European Jews need to come to these things on their own. He didn't believe in going in there and creating troubles for them. Now, when Hirsch came to Germany, you had modern communities. You even had rabbis who went to university. What you didn't have was an ideology of modern orthodoxy, an ideology that speaks about the values of these things. Outwardly, Hirsch appeared no different than Reform rabbis. He, too, wore a gown in services. He, too, spoke in High German. I mentioned last class also that in his school, in the Jewish State School in Frankfurt, Jewish students did not sit with their heads covered for the secular subjects. All this is clearly a response to outside pressures. There's no value, per se, in not wearing a kippah. But in Germany, it wasn't considered the acceptable thing. That's when people were in the non-Jewish world, that wasn't what was done. So Hirsch said, we will act this way as well. It's not an ikar, it's a tuffel. Now, it's interesting, though, that all we've spoken about, the one we'll continue to speak about for a little while longer today, nevertheless, Hirsch is in the pantheon of Haredi Gedolim. One wonders why. There certainly was no need. The Haredim have many, many Gedolim. But they want him for some reason. Now, it's this attitude of Hirsch, which is the subject of a famous essay by Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler. Who is Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler? He's a great Musar personality from the third generation, was in England right before the war, in Gateshead, and in the late 1940s he went to Ponevezh, where he was the Mashkiach, the Musar counselor there. Many of you have probably seen the English book, Strive for Truth, I believe it's called, the Hebrew Michtav Me Eliyahu, a very, very important figure. And he has an essay on Hirsch's approach. He was asked by people in Gateshead, they have a great yeshiva in Gateshead, and people wanted to establish also a school for those who were not set to learn all day, where they would, like a yeshiva university type of place, they would study Torah, but also be trained for professions. And in this essay, Dessler admits that Hirsch created a great community. In fact, there was very little attrition in Hirsch's community. Far from the case in Eastern Europe, where if you look, let's say, in the 1920s, every Hasidic family would have one child religious, one child not religious, especially among the girls. They lost a great numbers of people. Once Hirsch's community was established, there was very little attrition. So that's acknowledged by Rabbi Dessler. However, he elaborates on how they're not interested, that is, the yeshiva world, is not interested in creating communities. They're not interested in creating balabatim. They're interested in creating talmidei chachamim, gedolim. And he states, better 1,000 fall away, and one succeeds in becoming a gadol. Remember, the point of creating this, Jewish university in Gateshead was to keep people who were not set out, they were not willing or able or desirous of studying Torah all day to be able to study Torah half a day and get a secular education the other half a day. Because if you didn't provide them with that, they would go to the university, they would become non-religious. The source of Michtav Eliyahu, well, it's I'm holding it in front of me. You can also get it. It's in my book. I discussed it in my book on Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. I have the page here. I don't have the volume. If anyone's interested, I can certainly make copies and send them. Now, this is a very reactionary approach, which insists that Torah scholars are the essence of the community, no one else. Now, this essay also created a great deal of controversy. Rabbi Shimon Schwab published a letter against it. You find the idea disturbing, almost perverse. Well, so did Rabbi Shimon Schwab. In fact, in tradition, a few years ago, Schneur Lyman, in his column, translated this essay of Rabbi Dessler. But it is a true reflection of the yeshiva world's mentality. Rabbi Dessler says that we're not uninterested in those people who can't study Torah, but we will help them get jobs as tailors, as other things, merchants, but not professionals. They cannot be allowed to do that because that will destroy the ideal of great Torah study. You'll create balabatim. We don't want balabatim. And he quotes the Rambam's notion. The Rambam says at the beginning of the guide, if 1,000 are just fall away, but I reach one person, it's worth it. I mean, he writes about how only shopkeepers, plumbers, I guess you could say, electricians. It's unbelievable because today only Hasidim adopt that approach. So the Misnagdim, in America at least, all study at universities or want to become professionals. If you go to the Aguda convention tomorrow, it's full of lawyers. If you went 30 years ago, you wouldn't have any of them. It's interesting that this passage he quotes the Rambam is quoted by others as well. And this ties into what I mentioned about the East European approach, that Torim Derech Eretz is only an emergency measure. What's really interesting, though, is that Rabbi Dessler and others like him are really afraid. You see this in the letter that in Michtav Eliyahu, that if you, in Gateshead, in addition to the yeshiva, you also have like a university where they study Torah, you're going to lose the best and the brightest. People are going to see that you can become a professional, and they're going to abandon the yeshiva learning all day, and they're going to go to the university or go to this institute they were going to set up. And because they had no faith in the young, therefore this is off limits. And you can only have Torah study. And if someone wants to leave Yiddishkeit because of that, or if someone wants to leave the yeshiva world, we're going to have nothing to do with them. And they didn't think their way of life could continue unless the only thing offered was Torah study for everyone. And it's clear that they were wrong. We are in a generation today when many people are perfectly willing to give up secular educations, to give up university, and condemn themselves to a life of poverty because of an ideal. The same ideal that in the 1950s, Rabbi Dessler and others were terrified that if students were actually given a chance to be exposed to a more modern or modern orthodox approach of Torah and Derech Eretz, no one would be left in the yeshivas because everyone wants to earn a profession, make a decent living. Today we see, on the contrary, there are many people who are perfectly willing to give up all these things just to study Torah. Even those who go to college at night still go to spend all day in yeshiva. They don't have the same yetzer hara, the same evil inclination to go to the universities. This is a condition that could not be imagined years ago, that of a full-time yeshiva student who even when he's exposed to university education, wants nothing to do with it, or even if he gets a college degree, his value system has not changed at all. I spoke at Fordham a few weeks ago. You have all these yeshiva guys who have these BTL degrees who are going to get law degrees, and yet they still have a Haredi mentality. There has been a complete revolution in the last 40 years, and that the yeshivas are more powerful today than ever in history. It's not a problem or a question anymore if Lakewood or Mir are losing students to YU or JTS. On the contrary, YU is often losing its best to them. So we see how strong the yeshiva world is today, and by reading Rabbi Dessler's letter and other letters I could provide, we see how weak it was. It was 40 years ago and how 50 years ago, and how much they felt, how sensitive they were, and how weak, I guess is the best word, that if they allow in any form of modern orthodoxy, that will be it for the yeshiva ideal. Moving on with Hirsch, unless anyone has any comments. Hirsch was also a German patriot, and this undoubtedly led him to oppose Zionism. We've already spoken about some aspects of Hirsch, although modern orthodoxy is unimaginable without Hirsch. He didn't agree with everything that modern Orthodox today agree with. One of them is Zionism. Hirsch was not a Zionist. In fact, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, one of the originators of Chibat Zion, of Orthodox return to the land of Israel, wrote to Hirsch asking him for his support, and Hirsch wrote back that he thinks what Kalischer is doing is more than a little aveira. It's a terrible thing. Hirsch had the Satmar position, if you can imagine it. This great leader of modern Orthodoxy believed that Jews are destined to remain in the Galut until God redeems them. If an individual wants to go to the land of Israel, that's very nice. But we cannot establish a state, we cannot go en masse until the Messiah comes, and until that time, we are to remain loyal citizens, patriots, in the lands we are. And as I said, this is crazy from a modern perspective to think that one of these great modern Orthodox leaders was anti-Zionist, but Hirsch was far from alone with this. There are many other great German rabbinic figures, very modern in their outlook, who first of all thought it was not realistic to go to the land of Israel, and they thought it was unnecessary, and they thought it went against Jewish religious values. Jews are supposed to be in the Galut, they're supposed to spread their wisdom there, and when God calls us back, we will return. They differed from the Reform in that they actually believed that they would return, but they agreed with the Reform that Jews have a mission, they're supposed to spread the notions of monotheism, of Jewish values, etc. In general, Hirsch did not have an international outlook. He believed that his role was for German Jews and let the Gedolim of the East worry about the others. He was very successful in creating a small community in Frankfurt with very little attrition and at great financial sacrifice, because for many years, until, as we see, they were able to break away, the people in Frankfurt had to pay taxes to the general community as well as membership to Hirsch's own community. And even when they were given permission from the government in the 1870s not to pay taxes to the general community, they still had higher taxes to the Hirschian community. They had to support institutions without taking into account all the money from the rest of the community. So they really created a model community. However, his writings became the major text they studied. He became, think of what the role of Rav Soloveitchik in modern Orthodoxy today, the hagiography that's developed around him, the central feature of him, the myth that is Rav Soloveitchik now, that he's so central to modern Orthodoxy, everything revolves around him. It was 10 times as much in German Orthodoxy with regard to Hirsch, because Hirsch was the major figure. It's not like they were studying Talmud, and they also studied Hirsch, like people today will study the Rav, but also study many other things. Most of these people were illiterate in Hebrew in the Hirschian community. They were very pious. They read the Torah each week with Hirsch's commentary. They read his commentary on the Siddur. Hirsch was it for them. As you can imagine, this led to a very uncreative intellectual scene. You had a Dayan who decided halakha, you had a day school, and you had very pious communities. But if Hirsch never established a yeshiva, then that meant that a yeshiva wasn't necessary. And when Hirsch's son-in-law, Shlomo Breuer from Hungary, wanted to establish a yeshiva there, the community refused to support it. They actually argued that for our type of orthodoxy, Hirshian orthodoxy, yeshivas not only are not necessary, they are counterproductive. And the great yeshiva in Frankfurt, Breuer's yeshiva, was established with private funds. It was only later that the community agreed to fund it. It's incredible. Orthodox Jews arguing that yeshivas are not a good thing. There was one other aspect of his philosophy, which I mentioned last class, is not mentioned in the 19 letters, but came to be regarded as a central aspect of his philosophy, something which the Haredim have taken up very strongly, and the modern Orthodox have rejected it. Ironically, because in Eastern Europe, you never had separatism. The Brisker Rav was rabbi of the community of non-Orthodox Jews, of Bundists, of Orthodox, of Mizrahi. He was elected by all of them. There was no such thing as separatist communities of the sort I will discuss in Eastern Europe or Central Europe. Well, there was in Hungary and in Germany. Nowhere else. What was the situation? Well, when Hirsch came to Germany, the law was, as I mentioned last time, everyone who was Jewish had to pay taxes. And the community supported the old age home, the kosher kitchen, the school, and all the synagogues, including the Reform synagogues. Is this permissible according to Jewish law? Can Jews give money, pay money in taxes, when some of this money is going to be used to support the Reform rabbi? Hirsch was brought in. They had a separate community, a very small group of just Orthodox. There was also many Orthodox Jews who there was an Orthodox synagogue as well. But this was a small group that established itself with the goal of being separate from the non-Orthodox. They would pay their taxes because they had to, but they had no interest in being involved with the other groups, with the Reform, or I guess we would call the conservatives, and they would try to get the law changed so they didn't have to pay taxes. Hirsch actually argued in favor of freedom of conscience, that it goes against the liberal notions of Germany, liberal Germany, to force me as an Orthodox Jew to pay taxes to a community which supports an institution that's directly opposed to my view. It would be like forcing Catholics to support Protestant institutions and vice versa. He found liberal members of parliament who agreed with him, and they passed a law. But before they passed this law, when Hirsch was arguing, I shouldn't say that, even after they passed this law, when after they passed the law, Hirsch argued, therefore everyone is obligated. Can you hear me now? Hirsch argued, everyone is obligated to break away, to join his community, and it's against Jewish law to pay taxes to this community. This created a huge controversy. The great Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, the Orthodox rabbi in Frankfurt, was telling everyone that they would not be regarded as a faithful Jew unless they split up from the community, stopped paying taxes to the general community, and joined his community. And after all, the general community, they had closed down the mikveh. They really had been persecuting the Orthodox. But people were very reluctant to join with Hirsch. Even his greatest followers refused to pay taxes to the general community. Why? Well, first of all, Jews have been living in Frankfurt many hundreds of years. If you stop paying taxes to the general community, you lost your cemetery plots. You couldn't be buried in the communal cemetery. And it probably doesn't mean anything to Jews in America or Canada, but when your family had been living in Frankfurt for 300-400 years, and your grandfather and great-grandfather and everyone had been buried in that cemetery, that meant a great deal. Yes, the general Jewish community, until the mid-19th century, it was an Orthodox community. By the mid-19th century, it now had become Reform-dominated. But there was still a big Orthodox synagogue, and there was a cemetery. And if you stopped paying taxes to the general community, you could not be buried in that cemetery. That was very important for many Jews. In addition, there were Jews who, even though they loved Hirsch, and they loved his idea of Tarim Derech Eretz, they thought that these are still other Jews. They might be Reform Jews, but we have other values at stake together with them. Hirsch did not believe in having any involvement with them as groups. So therefore, Hirsch did not believe in fighting anti-Semitism together with them. the Orthodox as a group and the Reform as a group would not get together to fight anti-Semitism or go to the government, something which the Aguda even does today. What to do, though? The rabbi said you need to break away. Well, Hirsch was certainly a great rabbi, but the greatest rabbi in Germany, whose name was Rav Zalman Meir Bamberger, the Ad HaLevi. He was the last of the old-style German rabbis, no secular education, wrote many Sfarim, someone of the equivalent of the greatest rabbis in Eastern Europe. Leaders in Frankfurt of the Orthodox community called Bamberger to come to Frankfurt. And he came to Frankfurt, and he spoke to them. Before he came to Frankfurt, he actually had supported separating from the Reform in many other places. But when he came to Frankfurt and he heard the situation, and he heard from the local Orthodox Jews that the Reform agreed not to interfere with the Orthodox, and that the Orthodox monies would be going to Orthodox institutions and neutral institutions, he gave a psak that Orthodox Jews were no longer obligated to break away. As long as the Reform Jews would support the Orthodox institutions, they would not interfere with the choosing of rabbis or anything like that. There is nothing wrong with the Orthodox sitting together with the Reform on neutral matters, the old age home, anti-Semitism, making sure that the Jewish community, the garbage is cleaned up and that the Jewish community is united on certain Jewish issues. And this created enormous controversy. Hirsch was furious because he had already given up sock. And here comes Bamberger saying you don't need to break away. Hirsch immediately wrote a very sharp letter. You can find the whole correspondence in the collected writings of Hirsch. A very sharp letter attacking Bamberger. And Bamberger wrote a very sharp letter in reply. And Hirsch wrote a very sharp letter against him. In Hirsch's first letter, he said that according to Jewish law, when one rabbi gives a psak, the rav of a town, another rabbi cannot come in and challenge it. And we can all understand why that's important. If the rabbi in my town says that a certain mechitza, this is as high as you need for mechitza, or this food is kosher or not kosher, and another rabbi comes in, it'll create chaos, havoc. You don't, in big cities, it's not such an issue because there's a million rabbis. But in Frankfurt, you had Hirsch was the Orthodox rabbi. Bamberger replied that this halacha only is applicable when both rabbis are equal, or about equal. However, when one rabbi is much greater, then you can't tell, an local rabbi can't tell Ramosha Feinstein that if he was asked a shaila, he can't answer it because there's no comparison. And it was considered a great insult to Hirsch that Bamberger said that, basically, I'm the Rav, I'm the Gadol of Germany, and you're a nice preacher. So it created a lot of bad blood. One of the ironies here is that Bamberger was as far removed from modern Orthodoxy as you can imagine, an old-time Rav. In fact, it's perhaps because he was an old-time Rav that he could respond the way he did. Hirsch, who was doing so many modern things, who looked like a Reform rabbi for many, with the long gown, with the preaching, he had to show that his reforms were reforms with a small r, nothing in common with the Reform movement. Bamberger, on the other hand, no one would ever confuse him. He was an old-time rabbi posek. So if you want to sit together with the apikoros, with the heretic, and discuss how to make the old age home better, what's the problem? He didn't see it was an issue. And I will tell you that the East European Jews who came to Frankfurt, and many did come, none of them really joined the Frankfurt, the separatist community that Hirsch established. They joined the general community. They came from communities in which non-religious and religious were together, and they continued doing that. Hirsch's own community, very few people who paid taxes to it, stopped paying taxes to the general community, and it was the great disappointment of his life. Because Torah im Derech Eretz was central to him, but in his mind, Auschwitz separatism was also central, and the two were tied together. And one couldn't be a good Jew without Auschwitz. And one couldn't be a good Jew in Germany without Torah im Derech Eretz. In fact, in his attack on Bamberger, he points out that Bamberger doesn't appreciate Torah im Derech Eretz and has no involvement with it. And that's a negative thing for people reading the letter. And everyone has wondered, what's the relevance? Is he just trying to attack Bamberger, saying that Bamberger is an old-fashioned rabbi? And what?
Jacob Katz discusses this, and he shows, if you read the letter carefully, what Hirsch is doing is saying, just like we need Torim Derech Eretz for Orthodoxy to survive in Germany, because in the modern world, Bamberger's form of Judaism will never survive, so too you need Auschwitz. Because, you know, if you're together with the Reform, it'll dilute Orthodoxy. And only those people who have Torim Derech Eretz, who are sophisticated intellectually, who understand the modern world, who understand history, they will know the real danger of being in one community with the Reformers. It's precisely because Bamberger is not sophisticated. He's not a Torim Derech Eretz Jew. He doesn't see the problems. Had he been a Torim Derech Eretz Jew, then he never would have been able to conclude that it was okay to be in the same community with Reformers. So it's ironic that precisely if you're a Torim Derech Eretz Jew, you see the real dangers. And the unsophisticated, old-fashioned Jews who don't want to have any secular knowledge involvement, they don't understand history, they don't understand sociology, they think that you can be in one community with the Reformed Jews and it won't affect your Judaism. That's what Jacob Katz argues, and I believe he is correct. Outside of Frankfurt, only three other communities established separatist kahilas. Berlin was one of them as well. Any questions or comments? Okay, so then let's go on.
Art, may I interrupt?
Yes.
Who led the community in Berlin? I wasn't so aware of the separatist community in Berlin.
There was a separatist. I will speak in a few minutes about Hildesheimer, Israel Hildesheimer.
Right.
However, if you turn off the speaker, so look at the echo. In Berlin, they weren't so extremist. People said that in the joke in Germany was in Frankfurt, they said, Baruch Hashem, we are now allowed to separate from the Reformers. And in Berlin, they said, unfortunately, we have to separate from them. In other words, in Berlin, it was regarded as a much more important thing, but Hildesheimer had a separatist community. But his great student, the Matei Levi, Mordechai Horowitz, actually became Rav of the general community Orthodox segment. When Hirsch broke away, and all the other Orthodox Jews that remained in the general community, they needed a rabbi. So they brought in Hildesheimer's biggest student. Hildesheimer was upset, but he didn't break off ties with him. He remained close to him. And this Mordechai Horowitz became a big Rav. He opened his own yeshiva. He was a gadol. But Hirsch refused to be in the same room with him. And his shul, the famous Bornplatz shul, was regarded as in cherem. No real Hirschian would step foot in that shul. It was a huge dispute. They fought about everything, including, of course, the Erev. Mordechai Horowitz put up an Erev, and they refused to accept the Erev. Someone writes, it reminds me of the Rav and his approach, which forbids ecumenical dialogue. The Rav's approach was actually identical with Bamberger's approach, because the Rav held that in matters relating to the general community, our welfare, issues of Zionism, anti-Semitism, poverty, we cooperate with the non-religious. We can even cooperate with the non-Jews. However, in theological matters, we don't have any involvement. We don't get together and have dialogue with either non-Jews or Reform Jews. So his approach was identical to that of Bamberger, obviously much more sophisticated. The Rav, it's not just the Rav, it's his family tradition. In the Netziv, there's a famous tshuva in the Netziv against Hirsch's method. He's referring to what the Hungarians were doing, or Galicianos. He says that separatism is like a dagger in the heart of the Jewish people. This wasn't the Jew, and Rav Kook is very much into this, this wasn't the approach in Eastern Europe. They believed in one kahila, even the sinners have to be in one community. So, but the Rav, let me just stress, the Rav had no problem. Just say, the Rav had no problem with dialogue with Christians. Theological dialogue he had the problem with. For Hirsch, you couldn't have any dialogue on an organized basis. The Reform rabbis and the Orthodox rabbis couldn't get together to discuss anything, not even if it was had nothing to do with theology. He wanted total separation because he thought that once you start recognizing them in innocuous areas, it will lead to other things. And this is the Aguda approach today. I was a little surprised that Aguda broke its long-term policy, and at the rally a month and a half ago in front of the UN against the Iranian president, they actually agreed that their people should go. But everyone knows that the Aguda, they didn't even go to the Washington March because they are very troubled. They don't know yet how to maneuver this thing of getting together with the non-Orthodox or even the modern Orthodox. And that is the approach of, that is the Hirschian approach. No cooperation in any organized way.
Question, what I'm thinking is, the analogy I suggested, I realize this is a very loose one, the point I was making was just that the Rav is fine-tuning it for his time, just like Hirsch did, but of course the big difference is the Rav is dealing with people that have already left the religion, and Hirsch is dealing with people that were on their way out. So I would imagine if Hirsch were around today, he would not suggest that we saw it have anything to do with the non-Orthodox, because they're already so far gone.
It's a good point, but it's speculation. Many of the Reform in his generation were gone also. It's hard to say. The Rav, incidentally, was not that sympathetic. He had a great appreciation for German Orthodoxy, but it wasn't his thing. I don't know if that's true. You know, we can speculate just like today. Eugene Korn's big argument is that if the Rav was around today, he wouldn't have such a problem with dialogue with the Catholics, because the Catholics no longer insist on converting us. This is all speculation, so it's hard to know. As for the other question about the Vilna Gaon and Rav Salanter against creating Torah Lishma to counteract the Hasidic movement, what's new in Rav Chaim of Volozhin is that Torah Lishma is a form of worship. And what's new is that Torah study without, and this is developed by the Briskers, without any practical implications. That is, traditionally, people would study Torah to learn the halacha. But Torah study, if you will read the Rav's halachic man, the idea of Torah study for its own sake, that is, to a great degree, new. And if you look at Bamberger, for instance, he was very much focused on halacha. But Hirsch wasn't interested even in everyone studying halacha. In the pre-Chaim of Volozhin approach, everyone would study Torah. And if you were great, you studied Talmud, others would study Halacha. Hirsch was not interested in creating Torah scholars. The difference is, in Rav Chaim of Volozhin's day, they weren't interested in creating everyone a Torah scholar, but there still was an ideal of a Torah scholar. For Hirsch, it's almost like the Hasidic movement. In the Hasidic movement, who's the most important? It's not the Dayan, it's the Rebbe. And the Hasidim don't have this ideal of everyone trying to strive to become a Gadol B'Torah, and that's the highest. There's other ways to serve God. In Hirsch's community, yes, you had a die-in, and maybe someone's exceptional, they become a great Torah scholar. It's almost like the Syrian community today. But the job for the average person is not to sit and study Torah all day. You study a little Torah, and you live Torah in your life. It was a lifestyle. It was a community of lay people. Now, many people today will argue, Hirschian followers, that was because German Orthodoxy was so assimilated into the secular world, he had to start very low, and if you go to Breuer's today, they certainly have adopted the model of Torah study. It's hard to say. I mean, if you read what Hirsch writes, he's creating a community. It's hard to see how you can be a Torah scholar if you're also spending your time studying Schiller and being involved in the world. I will grant that if you look at his school, they offered very little Gemara per week, a few hours. I have no doubt that he regarded this as a compromise and that we actually have his plans for expanding and moving, but it was never going to be a situation where they'd learn all day. It would be a situation like we have today, where you sit and learn till 12 or 1 and then have secular studies in the afternoon. Where Hirsch's school, when he was around, they maybe studied one period of Talmud a day. So we actually study a lot more in our modern Orthodox schools than in Hirsch's community. Getting back to the Hirschian community, well, after he died, I mean, we had one person, one of his great followers, who said that had Hirsch been alive in the days of the Exodus, only God knows who would have been worthy of receiving the Torah, Hirsch or Moshe Rabbeinu. You had a very uncreative scene in Frankfurt, because basically you went from Torah, maybe a little Mishnah, Kiddush Shulchan Aruch, to Hirsch. He was the be-all and end-all. Everything was kept in Hirsch's spirit. Since Hirsch didn't pay attention to the Rambam, he didn't study Rambam's philosophy, so no one else thought it was important to study for him. The same thing with the other writings that that Hirsch didn't study. And Mordechai Breuer traces, I will get back to this a little later, what happens to this intellectual malaise. The one other aspect of Jewish intellectual history in the 19th century, which is blatant in its absence in Hirsch, is Wissenschaft des Judentums. Any of you been to Bar-Ilan or Bernard Revel Graduate School or read Jewish scholarship? The academic study, be it of Talmud, be it of Jewish history, Hirsch was very opposed to that. The followers of Hirsch received doctorates, but in areas such as English literature, not English, well, I mean German literature, philosophy, they didn't study, as in Berlin, they didn't study academic Jewish studies. Hirsch was not a Solomon Schechter. The academic study of Judaism is to study Jewish history critically, to study Bible critically, at least not the Pentateuch, but the rest of the books of the Bible, to study Jewish philosophical works, to study Talmud, look at questions of authorship, how the works were put together, her higher criticism of Talmud, lower criticism of Talmud. All these areas Hirsch had wanted nothing to do with. He didn't want to study Arabic so you can understand certain Hebrew words better. Jacob Barth, Israel Hildesheimer's son-in-law, taught Isaiah at the Rabbinical Center in Berlin. He taught the second Isaiah, that Isaiah was written by two prophets. He analyzed how the Song of Songs was written, when it was written. It wasn't written by Solomon, according to him. These were acceptable ideas, critical studies of the books of Isaiah. How was the Talmud put together? How was the Mishnah put together? Hirsch was a philosopher. He wasn't an academic scholar, and he really thought that this destroyed Torah study when you studied it this way. He was very much like a Buber or Rosenzweig in that he was a philosopher with a simple belief. He wasn't a Solomon Schechter or someone who examined things critically. Furthermore, for Hildesheimer in Berlin, although Hildesheimer was a brilliant man, he knew mathematics, he knew Latin, he knew Greek, he taught these at the seminary, secular studies for him were instrumental. You get the sense that if Hildesheimer believed that we could still be in the ghetto, that would be fine, but we're not in the ghetto. And Judaism in the 19th century can't be in the ghetto, therefore, we have to become educated. Hirsch, though, viewed these secular studies as inherently valuable, that there was something wrong with living in a ghetto. He says explicitly, you're cut off from civilization. So that's another big difference between the two. We get to the 20th century, however, especially World War I. Jews come into contact with Eastern Europe. Many soldiers were in the East. They see a different type of Judaism, a Judaism that they feel is more alive, more with it. What was German Orthodoxy? What did it become? It had become a bourgeois type of religious system. After the war, German culture was not what it used to be. There was a rise of anti-Semitism. Zionism had come on the scene, the economic collapse. There begins to develop a turning away from Hirschianism in Germany by the 1920s. I mean, it makes perfect sense. If Hirsch said, as he did, that everyone should be able to go to Switzerland and see the mountains of Switzerland and get a religious experience, you should be religiously inspired by Schiller and Goethe. Is this really a religion for the masses? This is really for the elites. How is the average person supposed to connect with this? Throw into it the Zionist aspect of German Orthodoxy, the, as I said, the lack of creativity. And by the 1920s, you have a turn to Eastern European Judaism in Germany. They even established a Torah und Musar society in Frankfurt. Just like today we have Jews who go off, young Jewish men and women who go off to study Torah in the land of Israel, you had people going to study in the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe and coming back and wanting nothing to do with modern orthodoxy of the Hirschian sort. They didn't want to know about German culture, they wanted Torah. Rabbi Schwab, who I mentioned before, who later became a great advocate of Torah Derech Peretz, he was at the forefront of this. In 1933, when he was 25 years old, he wrote a book arguing that Hirsch's system is no longer valid. It applied in the 19th century, but no longer, especially since it was so tied to German culture, and German culture was no longer welcoming to Jews in the Nazi era.
He said that the Hirschian vision was utopian for the reasons I mentioned. I mean, think of it today. You think of Rivera and Lichtenstein. I can see him getting inspired by Shakespeare, and it affects his religious sentiments. But is this something for the average person? Schwab even sent letters to the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. And in the next Torah Mata journal, I have a piece on this, asking them, is it even permitted to follow the approach of Hirsch anymore? This is incredible. Hirsch, a great Gadol, regarded with respect by the Jews of Eastern Europe, by the Gedolim of Eastern Europe, for saving German Orthodoxy. By the early 20th century, the Gedolim of Eastern Europe are being asked whether it is even permissible anymore for Jews in Germany to follow this approach. I will tell you that the Gedolim, for the most part, did not answer this question. Their attitude was, we can't cast aspersions on Hirsch. He did a very valuable thing. If you can move beyond that, that's great. But we're not going to interfere with German Orthodoxy. But as I said, the young were seeing that there's a gap between traditional Judaism and German Orthodoxy. And they began to move apart. So where did this lead to? If you would look at the typical German Jew in Frankfurt in the 1920s and 1930s, Isaac Breuer honestly said, I believe, quote, was not Gerhard Hauptmann more important to us than all the pious and learned rabbis? That was a Nobel Prize winner, a very important German literature. He wrote about how the only difference between the German Orthodox and their non-religious and non-Jewish neighbors was that the German Orthodox put on tefillin in the morning. But basically, their values were similar. High German cultural values. They went to synagogue on Saturday. The enlightened Christian went to church on Sunday. There wasn't much Jewish content in their lives. The conclusion you could draw was that German Jews, Orthodox Jews by the 1920s, what had actually been achieved was the Mendelssohnian vision, not the Hirschian vision. And we already spoke in the last class how the Mendelssohnian vision doesn't really have legs. Look at American Orthodoxy today. American Orthodox Jews, the typical American Orthodox Jew, he goes to shul, he'll put tefillin on, but what's really the values in his life? The television shows, the Super Bowl, Dougies? I mean, if you ask yourself honestly, how modern Orthodox Jews, this is one of the problems, the typical modern Orthodox Jew, how they differ from their non-Orthodox colleague or the non-Jewish colleague, it's really in the realm of ritual. For many of them, the thought processes are very similar. Well, it's very hard to pass on a form of Judaism when it's just a ritual. That was the problem of Orthodox Judaism in Germany in the 1930s, which led to East European Orthodoxy moving in. And that's the problem with modern Orthodoxy in America, Canada, which has led to the Haredi movement being very popular. When you sever the secular from the holy, which was the case for many German Orthodox Jews, what are you left with? That was the problem. As Eliezer Stern, a scholar in Israel, noted, the turn to the East, which began among German Orthodox in the early 20th century, found its culmination with the founding of Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael was founded by German Orthodox Jews. Their motto, their slogan was, we will give our culture to the East, and we will take their Torah. At the first Agudas Yisrael meeting, the Gedolim from the East, led by Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, said, we don't want your culture, but we will give you our Torah. And the German Orthodox agreed. And so began Agudas Yisrael. But at all the early Agudas Yisrael meetings, there was always room for German Orthodoxy on the dais. However, by the end of World War II, this was no longer the case, and in the 1960s, Mordechai Breuer, the son of Isaac Breuer, the theoretician of Aguda, the founder, declared that there was no longer any place for German Orthodox Jews in Aguda. And we'll get back to that in a minute. But, Washington Heights is a total Haredi community today, and the reason is simple in my mind. They came to Washington Heights as a Torah and Derech Eretz community, but they were Aguda people. In Frankfurt, they were Aguda people.
What that meant was that they followed the Aguda line on Zionism, but everyone knew that in Eastern Europe, you lived one way, and in Germany, you lived another way. You went to the university, etc. When they came, and they had their own community. When they came to America, they already began to practice as follows, saying, we'll still keep our German Orthodox identity, termed Derech Eretz, but we'll go to the Orthodox, the Lithuanian yeshivas. And they all went to Lakewood and other places as well. How long can you really keep a hashgacha going that way? It's really Rabbi Breuer's fault. He should have created his own yeshiva very early on. If you're going to learn Torah from Ravon Cutler, if he's your Rav, are you going to say you're not going to take his hashgacha? So that's what happened. The Washington Heights community became absorbed by the larger Haredi community. Time constraints really prevent me. Shimon Schwab was a Hirschian. He was a Hirschian Haredi. But he was a unique fellow, as was he was less Hirschian than his predecessor, and his successor of Migeli was even less Hirschian. The next one they're going to have will have no relevance to Hirsch. Rabbi Schwab tried to keep the term Derech Eretz idea alive, but it was very difficult because they didn't have an advanced institution of Torah study. He himself, in the 1960s, wrote very powerfully in favor of Torah Derech Eretz. After he changed his mind from what he was in the 30s, but it was a losing battle. So it's a community that that basically regards secular studies as instrumental, if that. And they argue that today you don't need it. We don't. It's a Lithuanian approach, basically. Now, time constraints prevent me from following the story into our century in any detail. But let me just mention a few interesting examples which show what this community was like. There's a famous rabbi named Edward Bieberfeld, a perfect example of Turin Derech Eretz. He actually became a doctor in his 30s. He had a son. He named his son Paul, Paul Bieberfeld. Later in Israel, Paul Bieberfeld, known as Pinchas Bieberfeld, edited a big Torah journal, became well-known in the yeshiva world. Why did he call his son Paul Bieberfeld? One of the leading Orthodox rabbis in Berlin named his son Paul Bieberfeld because his son was born right after this great one of the great victories in World War I, and he was naming him after Paul von Hindenburg. Emanuel Jacobovitz, whose father was the Ad Dasdin in Berlin, Rabbi Julius Jacobovitz. Emanuel Jacobovitz was named after Immanuel Kant, if you can believe that. Isaac Breuer had a picture of Kant on his wall. Great rabbis, Adolf Altman, a great rabbi in Germany, he had these pictures on his wall. Herzl, Hirsch, Chassam Sofer, and Mendelssohn. What type of Jews are these, which are so connected to German culture? Never before had observant Jews been so assimilated into a culture. And we must not forget that Germany was a Christian culture. Now, modern Orthodox Jews, even the most right-wing among them in America, are very assimilated into American culture. Not, I assume it's the same in Canada. It's not that way in Europe. When my friend from England was here, we went to Great Adventure on Pesach, and he saw all these Hasidim with the payas and everything, and he said he was shocked, because in England, they basically live in a ghetto in Stamford Hill. They would never come to some amusement park like this. But American Haredim and American Hasidim, they're very assimilated into America. But America's not a Christian culture. The German Orthodox were also very assimilated. But in one sense, the Hirschian vision has triumphed in the notion of mission, in trying to make the world a better place through the insights of Judaism. This is something which I think has triumphed across the board. It is not uncommon for even Haredi rabbis to appear on television, on radio, at non-Jewish events, trying to influence people, trying to speak about Jewish values. The Aguda has an office in Washington. America is receptive to this, and it's an open society, such as the one in which we live. In an open society like our society, Hirsch's ideology of Judaism, that Judaism is a force for human good, can really come to fruition. And Orthodox Jews today, even the Haredim, know that they don't need to be involved with the Reform, or even the modern Orthodox. They can appeal to government leaders, they can be involved in things on their own. In the years after Hirsch, as I mentioned, there was this uneasy coexistence between East and West. German Orthodoxy really ended when the Holocaust came. The fact remains that Torah Derech Eretz, at least in its true form, was only an episode. and it has not lived on in its totality, although certain aspects of it, have a lasting influence. Let me read you now the two final paragraphs of Mordechai Breuer's great book. Mordechai Breuer, the great-grandson of Hirsch, the grandson of Shlomo Breuer, the son of Isaac Breuer, wrote an amazing book, Modernity in an Age of Tradition in an Age of Modernity, about German Orthodoxy from 1870, I think from 88, the title says 1876, it really starts earlier. And this is what he says, and listen carefully. This is at the end of the book, in the epilogue, after going through the rise and fall of the great German Orthodox system. The method by which Hirsch wanted to solve the problem of spiritual Jewish survival in the 19th century, not the application of the method, but the method, is his true and lasting achievement. Neither the religious kibbutz nor the ultra-Orthodox education of girls, Beis Yaakov, are thinkable without him. The pioneering achievements of the Orthodox halachists in the German Empire points the way for today's modern Orthodoxy. Thus, modern German Orthodoxy was exemplary, encouraging, fruitful, and challenging for posterity. As for itself, in its pure form, it remained an episode, and that is indeed the case. We can look today about what modern Orthodoxy today brought in from German Orthodoxy. But German Orthodoxy, as it stood, with its great love of German culture, which is its complete assimilation into a non-Jewish society, its lack of interest in Zionism, its notions of Torah im Derech Eretz, as Derech Eretz joining together with Torah, it's really an episode. But as Breuer says, all these things, the notions of the religious Zionist movement, Hirsch was opposed to it, but the ideal that Judaism means so much more than just Torah study, that was then adopted by German Orthodox Jews who were so important in the Mizrahi movement. The founders of Orthodox education in the State of Israel are all German Orthodox Jews. And so much more. The modern day school movement is unimaginable. It was founded in Germany and is unimaginable without German Orthodoxy. So as a movement, it was only an episode. But its influence continues. Now, one thing which let me just give you one example of a Torah im Derech Eretz Jew. Torah Imada, episode, I'll mention that in a second. Take a person like Diane Grunfeld, the great translator of Hirsch's writings, great halachist, Diane on the London Basin. He was also an active member of Amnesty International. And that for him, and when I went through his papers, looking for material in London, you have all this stuff about Amnesty International, he was so involved as well as other organizations, that to him made so much sense, because to be a Torah and Derech Eretz Jew meant Torah and Derech Eretz, and Derech Eretz means doing things to help your other man. Today, modern Orthodox Jews even, they're not so interested in that. We're very close to ourselves. That is an example of a Torah and Derech Eretz Jew, or of Aaron Lichtenstein. Maybe it's impossible for there to be Torah and Derech Eretz other than these individuals. As for Torah Mada, I don't know. I mean, I think Torah Mada also, in its pure version, is simply an ideal. In the Lamb's version of synthesis, it's an ideal. But in the letters, in the 19 letters, the pages I made, if anyone reads them, you will find one passage that I just want to mention. I'm not going to read any of the passages, but it's very important because of who we're going to be looking at next week. Hirsch writes in a passage that we will see directly contradicted by Rav Kook, quote, "Land and soil were never Israel's bond of union. That function was always fulfilled solely by the common task set by the Torah." Now, this is, and in another passage, he talks about the return to Zion, that this is not something we do, and that when we're in the Galut, we only have a spiritual bond. We are a nation spiritually, but we don't have a national bond anymore until the day God brings us back. It's ambiguous, because clearly all Jews are Jews. But his point is that spirituality, the Torah, is what makes us a nation now. We will see next week direct contradictions. Right at the beginning of Orot, how, for Rav Kook, the land of Israel is the essential bond, not just something, a hechsher mitzvah, that enables us to be a good Jew when God brings us back, according to Hirsch. Remember what Hirsch says. Land and soil were never our bond of union. We'll stop here then. I think it was very productive, and we can take questions. Scott says he doesn't think he could deal with Orthodox Judaism without Hirsch. Well, I agree with you. You couldn't have a modern Orthodoxy without Hirsch, but on the other hand, today's modern Orthodoxy has moved beyond and apart from Hirsch on Zionism, on dealings with non-Orthodox Jews, on relationship to how we regard the Jewish people and the state of Israel. These are matters we haven't gone along with Hirsch, but that's okay, I think, because Hirsch provided the building block. So it is true when the Haredim get very upset when people say non-Orthodox Jews are the followers of Hirsch. In fact, the Breuer's people in Washington Heights want nothing to do with YU, and Rabbi Schwab wrote mockingly when they established the Hirsch chair of Torah and Derech Eretz at YU. But that's because their vision of Hirsch is locked in the 19th century. Modern Orthodox Jews have taken important elements of Hirsch, not taken all of them, and moved beyond them. 20th century approaches, 21st century approaches. And that's how all great figures are. Modern psychology moved beyond Freud, moved beyond Darwin, moved beyond Marx for the Marxists. Great thinkers always have movements that move beyond them, the neo-Darwinists, etc. And we have neo-Hirschians today as well. Okay, well, we haven't yet determined what the modern Orthodox approach is to know exactly. There's more than one modern Orthodox approach. We've seen Hirsch's approach. Next class and a little bit after that, we'll see Rav Kook's approach and two ways of understanding Rav Kook's approach. And then we're going to see Rabbi Chilak of Weimar's approach, and then there's Rav Soloveitchik's approach, and there's about 10 or 15 different models of modern Orthodoxy, so there's no one approach. Anyone have any other comments or questions?
Hey, happy Thanksgiving to all the Americans out there. We'll see you next week. Enjoy your turkey or whatever. That's also a modern Orthodox Jew.
One more question? Okay, someone has a question. I will say, incidentally, having turkey on Thanksgiving is a perfect example of Hirschian Orthodoxy. You're sharing with the civil religion of your society, and Soloveitchik also is very much into Thanksgiving. Or Schechter discusses this in Nefesh HaRav. But as right-wing Orthodoxy has assumed a position in America, obviously they're not so comfortable with this civil religion, and they've moved in a different direction. So Hirsch is still very important in this respect. Okay, there was one more question.
To how modern term Derek Hertz faded away in the decades, ending, I guess, in the 20s. After Hirsch, but I'm wondering, since he was so central to his community, almost immediately after he died, I would imagine they would have been in dire straits right at that point.
You broke up in the middle, so I only heard the end. Something about the Lubavitch. Repeat it quickly again. You were fine towards the end.
Since he was so central to the Torah and Derech Eretz community, Rav Hirsch, I would imagine that They were cast in some mass confusion the minute he passed away. How did they function without him at all?
It's a good question. Incidentally, the fact that you call him Rav Hirsch, that's a Haredi approach, or that's their model, because in German Orthodoxy, even his greatest followers only called him Hirsch. It was not thought, just like Kant, it's not thought to be disrespectful. He was Hirsch. Today, I guess it's thought to be disrespectful to call rabbis by their last name, so he's become also Rav Hirsch. But it's interesting, when you read the German Orthodox, they call him Hirsch. They didn't know what to do after he died. Many people wanted to appoint his son, Mendel Hirsch, who was the principal of the school, the rabbi. The problem was that he wasn't enough of a scholar, so they appointed his son-in-law. His son-in-law was a Hungarian who wasn't as sympathetic to Torah and Derech Eretz, and we don't have time to go into it now. It created huge controversies. His son-in-law was opposed by many people who thought he was breaking away from the Hirschian model. And when his son-in-law died, a huge feud broke out in Frankfurt over who would be the next rabbi. They actually ended up getting a Hungarian. They thought that was even better than getting another Breuer. So the community itself was never the same after Hirsch. And even in the community,
you had leading Mizrahi people, members of the Hirshian community, because when Hirsch was no longer on the scene, you no longer had the ideological conformity. It was, as Breuer says, it was only an episode. Isaac Breuer, when he left Frankfurt and went to the land of Israel, he even updated his position to a Torah in Derech Eretz Yisrael approach. So really, pure Hirshian orthodoxy only took place during his lifetime and among individuals, great individuals after. And I think, truth be told, we have to question whether German orthodoxy in the Hirshian model is really something that could ever be a mass movement, and if maybe the best we could hope for is a certain Mendelssohnian type of orthodoxy with all the good as well as all the bad it brings together with it. I think the story is still out. As you'll see in my next Torah, in the next Torah Mada journal, I discussed this very point, which was debated in the 30s. Is Torah Derech Eretz a failure, or, as some argued, as I mentioned, is Torah Derech Eretz the sort of system that you need 100 years? Just like you needed 100 years to see how the yeshiva world developed, you need 100 years to see where Torah Derech Eretz is going. And I mentioned the yeshiva world. If you look around today, you certainly see, it's only been in the last few years that you see a lot of negative aspects of the yeshiva world coming up. And I'm not just talking about the bombs being placed in Bonavej. Those who don't know, real bombs were placed outside the Rosh Yeshiva's house, the stabbing in Bonavej, the things. I'm talking about the fact that the yeshiva world has not been able in Israel to produce people who can make a living, who, I mean, there's real problems. Those took a long time to develop. The same thing with Hirshi and Derech Eretz. It's very easy to see the problems, but it was also argued that you need 100 years of raising people on this ideology till you can really find a modus vivendi and where people think like German Orthodox Jews and then bring Torah into it. So it's an open question whether Hirshianism failed or not. The fact is that we never know, because the Holocaust came and German Orthodoxy needed to be in one place. Once it was scattered to Israel, to America, to Canada, South Africa, without one community, it then came under the influence of Haredi institutions, of American-style institutions. So we never had that, you know, test tube to test whether Hirsch's approach could really have created wonderful communities without inertia that would go move on and create great Kiddush Hashem as he hoped for. Okay, well, let's quickly, someone sends a message. We will pick up next week, same time. We'll be moving into Rav Kook, a completely new way of looking at what the modern world means for Orthodoxy. And look forward, you know, please email me if there are things that weren't clear. I look forward to seeing you. One last question. Where today? Again, it depends. There is no Hirsch. You could say Bar Ilan University is. You could say the religious Zionist movement in Israel. On the one hand, you say, how is that possible? Hirsch wasn't a Zionist. On the other hand, Hirsch's grandson said that if you take Hirsch's ideas, which is Torah and Derech Eretz, that means whatever society you're in, you try to be involved in, now Jews are living in the land of Israel, that means Jews, even though we are not secular Zionists, need to be totally involved with the state in all its aspects, not like the Haredim who move off to B'nai B'rak. So you could say, therefore, that ironically, Torah and Derech Eretz finds its true continuation in the religious Zionist movement in Israel. What does it mean to be a Jew, a religious Zionist Jew? It means you study Torah, but you're also involved in government, you're in the army, you're settling the land, you're doing all these things. So you can make that case. You can say that modern Orthodox Jews in America, especially in the last 15 years, when you have a new modern Orthodoxy, they call it centrism, which doesn't cut corners halachically. We're not talking about the old modern Orthodox Jews that ate fish out. We're talking about halachically committed modern Orthodox Jews. All you have to do is go to the YU based medrash. You see them in Teaneck. You see them in Bergenfield. You see them in Toronto. You see them at Torah in Motion. People who are more interested in learning Torah than in watching basketball games. Now you're going to say again, well, what's going on here? These people study Talmud day and night, many of them. They're more halachic focused. They're not interested in philosophy like Hirsch, but that doesn't matter, because we're not interested in creating epigones. If you're asking where Torah Derech Eretz has gone, it's gone in all these directions. And we're all students of Hirsch, and we all gain from him.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll see
okay,
everyone next week.
Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.